and information. It is Bare Bones Broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are VeraIconaPublishers.org and YouTube.com/VeraIcona100. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. And we were talking just before we started the recording about Glyvis. And do you want to say anything about the book that you just found?
I found the German White Book on, you know, the whole 1939, and it should include pretty much everything with regards to Poland before the outbreak of the war. So that's going to have the independent investigation conducted by Arthur Naba, who incidentally implicated some people himself, possibly. I came across a document that it has his name in it, or it's signed by him or something on the IMT site, on that Harvard website, and he is somehow kind of implicated with the whole doctor's plot thing. So there's big questions around Naba himself. He was an anti-Hitler traitor and was apparently tipped off and tried to flee. Let me see. I think he died in 1945. Yes. So he died or vanished in 1945. Nobody's sure what exactly happened to Arthur Naba, whether he was killed by the Gestapo because he was found out, or whether the Allies got him and killed him. No one knows. But he's the one who conducted the investigation into what actually happened at Gliwice, which, according to pretty much everybody who was either kind of an eyewitness there or a neighbor, nothing happened. It was literally a visitation by two or three members of the SS who properly identified themselves, who allegedly did some kind of training in German and Polish on the weather microphone, which makes sense. It allegedly didn't broadcast out to anyone. And this would be why Heydrich didn't actually hear the alleged broadcast that Naujox gave, because when you do like a weather interference broadcast with the local microphone, it doesn't broadcast out. It just does the local area of Gliwice itself.
Right.
That would explain why this Polish-German exercise didn't broadcast out further. But it did take place, according to eyewitnesses, which makes sense in the context of a war coming up between the two countries. And then they just left. It was a Heil Hitler, and then off they went. Nothing happened. The question that no one can answer is, how did a broadcast get into the BBC's news and the New York Times, who then attributed it to the German news, that something happened there, a shootout, and that there were bodies found?
Indeed.
Because Naba's investigation revealed nothing. And, of course, the Allies after the fact go, oh, yeah, the Nazis covered the whole thing up. They lied. No, nothing happened. And that's why the NSDAP initiated an investigation into it. And the reason the Germans were a little reluctant to have, like, neutral parties come in or allied parties come in and try to investigate what may have happened is because they didn't want the possibility that the Allies would blow it up into something in their favor propagandistically. So, you know, tensions were high at the time. Germans wanted control over that. But, you know, again, eyewitnesses, et cetera, nothing happened. And there was a border regiment there, a border guard regiment. And, of course, they said nothing happened. Nobody would have gotten past us. Now, see, the whole story revolves around this Alfred Naujox and his two precious affidavits that were presented to the IMT, which are just full of contradictions and absurdities. They also have misspellings, Americanizations of certain German terms, etc., typed up on plain white paper and then probably pushed in front of him and he signed them.
Sure.
And of course, he survived the war untouched and became a rather wealthy man. So
yes, I wonder how he became a wealthy man.
Exactly. He definitely sold out. Real quick, you know, people always act like this was Hitler's casus belli or causus belli, however you say that. And they attribute, where is that one quote? Let's see if I can find that. Okay, they say that Hitler addressed the German nation on the radio, and the invasion already underway, he condemned the intolerable Polish aggression at Gliwice and declared war. Earlier, however, Hitler had remarked to his generals, quote, "I shall give a propaganda reason for starting the war, whether it is plausible or not. The victor will not be asked whether he told the truth," end quote. Now, this quote is lifted from General Halder. In General Halder's diary, which I have, it's page 31, August 22nd, 1939. He has a section to the Führer's demands on his military chiefs. The first thing is hard determination, and so he says, "Counter moves by Britain and France must be expected. We must stand fast. Build-up plan for Western frontier will be set in operation. Iron steadfastness of all responsible authorities." That's in quotes, so presumably Hitler actually said that. Point two is goal. So it literally says goal and then colon. Annihilation of Poland. That is destruction of active power. He's talking about military power, obviously. "We are not setting out just to reach a specific line or establish a new frontier, but rather we seek the annihilation of the enemy, which we must pursue in ever new ways." Now, Hitler is not actually telling us what those new ways are. We don't know what that means. That could be Stuka dive bombers. It could be mass, you know, tank artillery type. You know, he's not specifying. So then he says, point three, the means to the end of achieving the annihilation of Poland. This isn't simply like a territorial war or a regime change or anything like that. This is going to be crushing their military force so that we can come in and take back this portion and then set up the general government, etc. They only annexed part of Poland, and those would be the traditional German areas. The rest of it was set up as what is called the general government. That was not officially annexed. So he says, means to this end. It does not matter what they are. The victor is never called upon to vindicate his actions. The question is not one of the justice of our cause, but exclusively of achieving victory. Now, again, this is coming through Halder, but when we compare that quote to the one that's actually usually attributed to Hitler, where he specifically mentions propaganda, we can see where that quote comes from. Again, he says, supposedly, "I shall give a propaganda reason for starting the war, whether it's plausible or not." So that's kind of like, whether it looks ridiculous or not, it doesn't matter to me. And then the victor will not be asked whether he told the truth. That is not the same quote as, "The victor is never called upon to vindicate his actions. The question is not one of the justice of our cause, but exclusively of achieving victory." Again, Hitler is probably, we don't know because he's not specifically saying, but probably thinking of civilian casualties. If it's necessary, we're going to do it. Annihilation of a country's armed forces tends to be kind of a zero-sum war. It can get really ugly. In some cases in Poland, it did get a little bit nasty. For example, the leveling of Warsaw after the Warsaw Uprising. That's more than likely what he's referring to, and he does not mention starting the war at all. He doesn't say, "I'm going to come up with a propaganda reason to start the war." That's nowhere in this quote of Halder's. So what somebody did is they took Halder's quote and then modified it to fit their ends.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And we don't know if Halder's being 100% honest himself.
Right.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, since the British guarantee of March 31st, 1939 gave Poland carte blanche in its dealings with Germany, Poland intensified its persecutions of the German minority. Now, everybody claims, or most of these historians, that Hitler made that up, that there were no, you know, outrages against the German minority, but that's just not true. There were all kinds of things going on behind the scenes, including, I believe it was some kind of blockade of Danzig enacted by Poland, and supplies were prevented from coming in. And so this was a potential risk of hunger, among other things. On top of that, abductions became common. Now, this isn't necessarily the Polish government abducting German minorities. It could be communists. It could be simply Polish civilians acting of their own accord, but it doesn't matter. It's still an outrage, and it's being tolerated by the state, and Germany has the right to react.
Right.
Speaking German in public was proscribed. German associations and newspapers were suppressed. The German consul in Krakow was murdered, etc. It is Yeah. And this is coming from, what's his name? Jürgen Rieger. His website is literally jürgenrieger.de. It's a German. I think this essay in particular is in English, but he wrote a lot in German, and I think he's deceased now. But the title of this essay is Lies About German War Guilt. It's very good. And then, of course, he wrote, it is irrelevant whether Poles or Germans attacked the Gliwice transmitting station. Whoever reads the white book of the German-Polish war will find countless undisputed murders and assaults committed by the Poles in the weeks and months preceding September 1st, 1939. We're talking about months before, in some cases. Hitler didn't need a last-second casus belli. And, I mean, these guys are cute with their story. The one guy, I believe it was Rasch, but we're going to go into that in a minute. And he's the one who was allegedly supposed to have kind of a shootout between fake Poles and fake Germans, who are all SS men, really, at Hochlinden. Well, this guy doesn't even finish up until 4:47. He starts at 4 a.m., finishes up at 4:47. The British press is reporting an incident at Hochlinden at 10:30 p.m., okay, he's not done until 4:47 a.m. the next day. He doesn't start until 4 a.m., and the British press is reporting on Hochlinden at 10:30 p.m. Whoops! Jump the gun, guys.
That reminds us of the Building 7 when the BBC was reporting that the building had fallen and it's standing right behind her, intact.
Mm-hmm. You see, they don't always get the timing right. And, of course, there's the nose-out shot in that video, too. Whoops! Yeah. And that would explain why the banner had to go over the plane.
Right.
They're hiding the most explosive news story ever with their stupid CNN banner. Sure. Yeah. Exactly. So, whoops, the international press jumped the gun. Now, that has led some historians to suspect that a very minor exercise that was conducted by the Germans, you know, the SS being there, coming in, doing their little exercise, blah, 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 that was incorporated into the story. But then, in fact, Poles, who were probably located at this posh bank branch in the vicinity, which Carlos Porter mentions, I think David Hogan mentions it too. There's this bank that suddenly all the staff disappeared the next day after private.
Right.
A little strange.
Mm-hmm.
So more than likely that would have been the insurgency, the insurgents and the insurgency location. And then they would have been the ones who murdered Haniak and this other individual who were left at the scene. Now, there's another problem here. The bodies disappeared. So now we have a question, was anyone ever even shot? That cannot actually be confirmed. Honeyock's body never showed up, and he's allegedly the first man to die in World War II. And this other guy, who was supposedly a concentration camp inmate, or perhaps even the German who announced in Polish for Nowyaks, his body disappeared as well. Well, what happened to them? And then, of course, we have the eyewitnesses who testified that there were no gunshots, so that therein would exonerate any Polish insurgents from actually being guilty. Was this 100% invented by the international press? It's possible.
Quite possibly.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of more and more where I'm heading. I don't even think any Poles participated in this. And, of course, I don't know why they have not done an investigation into this. One would think that Germans and Poles would want to get together on this, because this is pretty – it looks bad for both sides, really. And one would think now, 70 years later, isn't it time to get the truth?
I wonder, because look at all the other things that have happened in the past. And they have a fake commission that, you know, it's stacked to produce the government's version of anything.
Right.
And then you don't have those independent researchers that actually go in and do the investigation. It just does never seem to happen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, of course, we have one source claiming that Hitler didn't even fire until September 2nd. Now, the traditional story is that at 4:45 a.m. on September 1st, 1939, the German battleship Schleswig-Holstein opened fire without warning, and they killed 1,200 civilians. I'm not sure about that either. Sounds like another potential false flag. And now, of course, the Lusitania may have, in fact, been blasted by a Britzy torpedo.
I'm sure.
That's the latest now. Right. So I'm not totally sure what I think about this incident that happened on the Westerplatte Fort off Danzig. This ship. Hard to say.
It is.
And then, of course, we also have the fact, and this is in that Stephen book on the Gleiwitz incident, which you get that. It's very cheap. The real cost is the shipping from Britain. It costs a lot. But it's worth it, I think, that Poland invaded East Prussia on September 1st. They invaded Teutoburg, which is Margrabowa in Polish. So, whoops. There's your invasion right there. I mean, if Hitler wanted any excuse, he could have said, aha, Teutoburg, now I can leap like a tiger. And, you know, that didn't happen. So, yeah, he didn't need some fake shootout and potentially risking exposure. And, of course, according to the official story, Heydrich bungled this thing so bad that they had to call it off at the last second. But it was too late. One of the groups of false flaggers had accidentally gone in without the code word and had started the fake insurrection. And Hitler had called off the war. He'd postponed and said, all right, wait, we're not going to invade yet. Last minute thing. Whoops. I mean, that is so idiotic, I can't even believe it. Apparently these historians believe it. And Heydrich, of all people, I don't think so. And, of course, Heydrich allegedly picked Mailhorn to orchestrate that aspect of the attack because of his incredible gifts at organization. So
really?
Would Mailhorn be the one to not get the code word and have his guy?
Right.
Totally idiotic. And then, of course, Heydrich is fuming, calls them all to Berlin from Gleiwitz. Who knows how many miles that is. Yeah, you guys all have to drive here or fly here. I don't care. You know, just come here so I can fume at you. He dismisses two of them. You two bungled this so bad, you're fired. This is, kind of idiocy that supposedly occurred before the actual Gleiwitz incident, that they had kind of a false start. That's ridiculous. It really is. Carlos Porter mentions the Poles had a posh bank branch near the station that did very little business, and immediately after the so-called incident at Gleiwitz, all the staff suddenly disappeared. We need to find out what that was all about, honestly.
Right.
I mean, were they part of the radio psyop?
Yes, it's very interesting that they would have a bank in that place
sure.
to begin with. Yeah, it just doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, and how did it stay in business?
Yes.
Okay, and then, supposedly, Hitler condemned the intolerable Polish aggression at Gleiwitz and declared war at 5:40 a.m. This was on September 1st. No, he didn't. He didn't even mention Gleiwitz, and no one had knowledge of Gleiwitz until the IMD trial. Now, the funnest part of this whole case is that it wasn't until the Germans actually, the East Germans in fact, made a movie about it, that the West Germans went, wait a minute here, did Nyack really shoot a man? Did they kill all these concentration camp inmates and pose them as Poles and leave them at the scene? This is a murder. Malicious intent. We need an investigation. And so they go to bring Nyack to trial, and he died before he could be brought to trial.
Now, that was when did he die? Okay. In 1960-something?
66. Supposedly, but there are many different years for his death. That's another interesting thing. We have discrepancies there. Let me go to this Karl Heinz Hoffman testimony, IMT, because this is very revealing. July 26th to August 8th, 1946. Karl Heinz Hoffman. Now, I cannot confirm, in fact, which Hoffman was allegedly participating in Gleiwitz. The problem is, you look up his name and you can't find a single thing on this guy. And it's like, okay, if he was included as a prominent figure in Gleiwitz, one would think there would be some kind of prominent SS file to go with him. Can't. So whether or not Karl Heinz Hoffman is the same man, not sure. But this guy's testimony is important nevertheless, because the Gestapo has been implicated in Gleiwitz. So the IMT asks, was it not the task of the Gestapo to further the ideological aims of the party? He answers, no. The tasks of the state police were purely counterintelligence against attacks directed against the state, and that within the legal provisions and regulations. So this idea that the Gestapo was kind of the all-seeing eye, played by its own rules, could flout anything it wanted, absolute lie.
Well, that's not what they say in the movies.
Exactly. And who knows? Especially Steven Spielberg.
Right.
Okay, so next question. The basic tendency and work of the Gestapo, therefore, was it aggressive or purely defensive? His answer, it was defensive and not aggressive. That could be seen, first of all, from the following fact. When, in 1944, the duties of the counterintelligence offices were transferred to police and SD offices, the state police received only the purely counterintelligence tasks, whereas active espionage and sabotage were transferred to Amt Mil, or Amt 6, which means Department 6. So here we have kind of the designation of clear jurisdiction. Okay, the SD and the Gestapo and the SS weren't all, like, converging and tromping on each other's territory and I'll do this and you do that. And, you know, the whole Gleiwitz incident, especially in this After the Battle article, it's called After the Battle. I believe it's a British production. It's called The Gleiwitz Incident, and it's number 142. I mean, these guys don't understand that they're are designated jurisdictions of each agency. You don't Gestapo playing around with SD, with SS, and everybody's kind of, you know, stepping on each other's territory. They have it all so convoluted, it's ridiculous. So, you know, this clarifies a little bit of that. One can probably just look on the internet for a chart that delineates this, that shows you everybody's jurisdiction and where, you know, Heydrich's authority was, where Himmler's authority was, and where Gestapo Mueller's authority would have been. I mean, for instance, we have Naujoks telling Gestapo Mueller, Heinrich Mueller, what to do. No, not going to happen. So next question, did the Gestapo take part in a conspiracy, the purpose of which was the planning, preparing, and waging of aggressive war? Now, this would be precisely hinting at Gleiwitz. Heinz Hoffmann says, I have to deny that. As advisor for defense to the inspector of Wehrkreis, District 6, who was the head of six state police offices, I had no previous knowledge of an aggressive war being prepared. When Norway and Denmark were occupied, I learned the news from the newspapers. Isn't that revealing? He didn't even know until he read the news. Okay, so, you know, very secretive. As deputy leader of the Gestapo office in Dusseldorf, I did not have any previous knowledge of the date set for the offensive in the West. The morning of that day, I heard of it by radio and the newspapers. When the campaign against Russia was started, I was an expert in the Gestapo office. Several days later, it may have been 3 or 4 days, we were informed of the beginning of the offensive. Before that, we had no idea whatsoever about such plans. That is to say, not any more than any German could have gathered from the political tension. So that's all I could find on Karl Hoffmann. And again, this is Karl Heinz Hoffmann. Whether it's the same guy, not totally sure, but it probably is, because there's not too many Karl Hoffmanns in the Gestapo that come up. So again, this idea that the Gestapo is this all-seeing eye and would be involved in something like this, no. No, the Wehrmacht and perhaps a very small commando force, yes. Not the Gestapo. The Gestapo is just the secret state police. They don't go around starting false flags. So
right.
We have this written by somebody who just doesn't understand how the whole thing works.
Can you compare the Gestapo to what in this country?
What would the Gestapo be like?
It wouldn't be like the FBI, would it?
Well, the FBI can't really start a war.
Right.
So maybe I would compare it, closest thing would be FBI, and CIA would be SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, which Heydrich was in charge of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they had to involve the SD in this, but there are no other instances that the SD was implicated in war-wise. As far as, like, you know, a false flag, it was always pinned on the Wehrmacht and Hitler.
Right.
So that doesn't make sense either. Now, that's not to say that our CIA doesn't do that kind of stuff.
Right. And, of course, they wouldn't have, well, the CIA was created, what, in 1947. I'm trying to think of how they might be thinking, you know.
I would call it more of a special ops mission would be to orchestrate a false flag.
Right, okay.
The 9/11 thing really convolutes stuff, because that's so far out in left field. I don't know if any country has ever experienced something of that nature. That's kind of extra monstrosity, that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're talking about government, perhaps military complicity, foreign government involvement, fifth column activity, all in one event.
Right.
And corporate interests. Yes. Nothing like that ever happened in NS Germany. I don't even think the Germans could conceive of something that monstrous and insane. It's so...
Right. It's a Jewish thing.
It really is. Yes. It just, that's too criminal. And there, again, there's nothing that they did that even remotely equates to that. That's why it's so silly when people go, oh, yeah, the Gestapo is going to, the American Gestapo is going to come get us. And I, yeah, Gestapo. And, you know, again, in Hitler and Himmler Uncensored, Himmler himself talks about how the Gestapo is a very honorable, as well as the SD, a very honorable kind of military organization. He says, we don't go around spying on our people, you know, with this informant system like the USSR. We don't need that. We've done that. This doesn't, the Germans don't need that. And he even comments, I believe it's SS Defender Against Death and the Devil. It's one of those Preuss publications on ThirdReichBooks.com. I have it where, and it has a quote by Himmler. And he says, if when the SS shows up and they see our black uniforms, or the Gestapo, when we are in uniform, generally they didn't wear uniforms. He said, when we come up on, you know, some suspected communist outfit or whatever, he said, if they're guilty, they should be afraid of our uniforms. That's a good thing. He said, they should be afraid, and I'm glad. But he said, but the German people should never fear this uniform or this organization. There's no reason. So again, it just, they weren't striking fear into the hearts of every German. This is just nonsense. And there were plenty of Germans listening to the BBC. Now, if the German government really wanted to cut off foreign radio, they could have done it. Stalin certainly did. You know?
Right.
We got to get over this idea that NS Germany was a police state. It just, it was not a police state.
There's been so much propaganda during the war, right before the war. There was so much propaganda during World War I that this vilification of Germany has been going on for over 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's very embedded. And people just believe it because it is so deeply embedded.
Right. And I mean, if that isn't good enough and one can undermine that side of the lies, then they go, oh, well, Hitler was a Zionist agent and he was best friends with Lord Rothschild. Come on. Or he was Rothschild's grandson. They don't look a thing alike. And the thing is, people, you need to go to Hitler's father, not his mother, his father. And look at his picture and compare it to the Rothschilds. They don't look a thing, not a thing alike. It's just, it's totally
ridiculous.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, so as far as Hitler needing an excuse, let's just hammer out a couple more things here. In May 1939, on Polish Constitution Day, according to J.A. Koffler in his book Die falsche Rolle mit Deutschland, which is the counterfeit role with Germany, the most intimidating statement made was, quote, the German demand for an artery to East Prussia in Danzig's return to Germany must be answered with war against Germany. The ridiculous German army, consisting of the undernourished generation of the Treaty of Versailles, with its silly dummy tanks, would be thoroughly trounced in Berlin. Now, this is a Polish official saying this. Okay, so they're not kittens. We have to get over this Polish kitten idea.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
They actually were better militarily than Germany was.
Sure.
And you know, growing up,
500,000 I was men mobilized.
Right. And yet we were all brought up thinking that all they had was horses and some, you know, swords. But they had more planes. They had a lot more than Germany did.
Sure. And that myth has also been blown away, that it was the Polish cavalry versus German tanks. Just a bunch.
Right.
Okay, so, and then we have British Colonel John C. Scott. And this is mentioned also in not only the book, The Venlo Incident, but in Lewis Kilzer's book, I believe Schellenberg also wrote about this in his memoirs, Labyrinth. Got to be a little careful with Schellenberg. He interwove many lies into his memoirs for his own reasons. So you have to read them with the grain. But this is mentioned. by these other sources and corroborated. So this Colonel John C. Scott, he was a transmitter in the negotiations between the Allies and the German Foreign Office. And he mentioned that the Allies gave the Reich two conditions, and their acceptance would have brought about an immediate cessation of hostilities and a free rein for Germany and Poland. Those conditions were: Germany must return to the gold standard, and the League of Freemasonry must be readmitted to Germany.
Oh, my.
That tells you right there.
Yes.
So they, you know, if Germany was Freemasonic or accepted by the Freemasons or even tolerable to Freemasons, that would not have been in there. If Hitler was working with Rothschild or subordinate or dependent on Rothschild, gold standard wouldn't have been in there.
Exactly.
You know, this undermines that nonsense right there. And this was not published until November 6th, 1947, in Tomorrow. But again, Kiltzer mentions it. Schellenberg mentions it. This was also put forward during the Venlo incident. And incidentally, Naujoks was there. He was part of the Venlo incident where, you know, the Germans kind of blasted across the border really quick, grabbed two Brizzi agents and then shot back across that border. It's really quite a funny story, actually. They just ramrodded right through the border, the border gate in this Mercedes or something like that. But this is written by William J. Scott, and it's called Why Hitler Invaded Poland. So that's another essay that I found on the internet, and that's a good one. Okay, so now we can go ahead and let's go to the fates of some of these people. We already know that Arthur Naba was allegedly a doctor. He's the one who supposedly injected all these concentration camp inmates and made them nearly unconscious so that they could be shot and left dead at the scene, which in fact never happened. He died or vanished. Joseph Gertzemek was executed by Poland on January 29th, 1949, was the beginning of, I believe that was the beginning of his Polish trial. And on February 18th, 1950, he was executed. Now, the problem is Gertzemek could never clear his name. So he's one of the other ones in there who, you know, was never given a chance to tell us the truth. And he might not have even told us the truth. For example, Naujoks, who never did, even if he had been given the chance for his own reasons. No one wants to admit they lied to the IMT and implicated a whole bunch of innocent men, because that's what Naujoks did.
Sure.
He implicated all kinds of people. Karl Hoffman, or Karl Heinz Hoffman, he was given a 20-year sentence. So on January 19th, 1950, his death sentence became a 20-year sentence. He was released on July 9th, 1952 and expelled from Denmark. So with him, the fact that he got his sentence commuted to 20 years, more than likely he told some nice details.
Sure.
So we'll leave that at that. I have some more of these. I found an entire list of all the NSDAP members, SS members, etc., who were executed by Poland on Axis. I think it's Axis History Forum. They have Joseph Gertzemek listed on there. And Fritz Neumann. He was executed on May 13th, 1949. He's another one in the story. So, again, we have another man who was killed in 1949 who can't clear his name or tell us the truth.
Handy.
Yeah, it's very convenient. I think those were the only ones. Oh, and of course we have Wilhelm Canaris, our favorite in the story. He had to be in there.
Oh, yes.
anti-Hitler traitor. You know, he was killed by the NSDAP, so, you know, he couldn't tell us what all he knew or didn't know. And, of course, Heinrich Müller disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to him. he supposedly died in a final battle of Berlin or something like that, but no one's sure. Some Germans testified to seeing him in a Soviet uniform in the USSR after the war, and they were interrogated by him. Whether that's true, who knows? There's other people that claim he was working for the CIA. So I guess Mueller was kind of that enigmatic figure because nobody knows what happened to him. But he plays a prominent role in the story. So I'm going to go to this After the Battle article and just go through, you know, paragraph by paragraph, the insanity. First of all, we've got basically Hitler et al. Kind of fumbling around for, you know, a reason for war immediately before the war is going to be launched. Okay, they have 6 months when, you know, Hitler is pretty much set on a war with Poland. Case White, Fall Weiss, March 1939 after Czechoslovakia, so we're thinking around May 1st, he's starting to draw up plans for the Polish problem. So they have 6 months, but they wait until, like, the month of, and then literally jump the gun because Hitler's not totally sure yet that he actually wants to go to war. He's still hoping for that last minute, you know, we're not going to go to war, we're not actually going to shoot, we're going to have peace, and we're going to give you what you want. Okay, so literally to the last second that these people are wrapping up their false flag at 4:47 a.m., and Hitler is giving a speech at 5:40 a.m., the one where he's supposed to be citing his reason for war as Gleiwitz, Hochlinden, etc., when they're wrapping up the false flag at 4:45, or 4:47, that's about an hour? Nonsensical.
Yeah.
Nonsensical. In 1934, there was a non-aggression pact with Poland. What happened to that? You know, we should really ask that question. What caused that falling out?
Yeah, that was on, what, January 26, 1934.
Yeah.
Now, did they... That was signed with Göring and Pilsudski?
Right. Joseph Beck and Joseph Piłsudski were quite amenable to the Germans.
Right.
One ended up fleeing. We know Joseph Beck fled to, I believe it was it Romania? And then died.
Probably.
It was either Hungary or Romania after the start of the war. He dies of tuberculosis. That's a little strange. And Piłsudski allegedly died of heart failure?
On May 12, 1935.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. We need to look into what caused that falling out. British meddling.
Well, didn't William C. Bullitt, Rothschild's European agent, kind of take over some sort of an affiliation with the Polish leadership after Piłsudski died?
Well, that would explain it right there. We really need to start asking what sabotaged that whole relationship, because for Poland to tell Germany to get out, we got France and Britain going to back us, when the Soviet Union is literally on your border, and Hitler is offering to help defend Poland against any aggressive act by the USSR.
Right.
That doesn't make any sense. It was totally against Poland's interests.
But then Bullitt basically promised that that if Germany did invade, that the U.S. government, the U.S. military and the British government would come in and help defend Poland.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they say that?
Right. But again, who in Poland actually bought that? I mean...
Yeah.
Their rulers were rather interesting. Of course, in this wonderful essay written by Dennis Whitehead, and after the battle, he claims that Hitler gives that, you know, propagandistic cause for the war on August 22nd. Of course, he gives us no citation. You don't need a citation for that. Of course, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was ratified on August 23rd, 24th, so keeping that in mind, Hitler's not totally sure he's going to side with the USSR until that point. That was really a reluctant step on his part, too. He did not really want to do that. Kind of just forced into it. And the USSR was also kind of forced into it because Stalin had offered 150 divisions to the French and Britzies if they would help him invade Germany. And of course, the French and Britzies said, no, we can't do that. So it just goes to show you how peaceable they were.
Right.
Let's see. Okay, so Operation Tannenberg is how this is described. Now, on Wikipedia and other places, and some books even, they call it Operation Himmler. So we don't even know what it's called. Is it Operation Tannenberg or Himmler? Not sure. So basically, here's the pretext that Hitler didn't need or even use. If Germany could provide proof of Polish aggression against her, this would leave England and France without grounds for a declaration of war against her. How idiotic. The English and French would have found grounds for declaring war no matter what. That's just nonsensical. And the problem is Hitler didn't even cite Gleiwitz. Even in the white paper, it's mentioned only as a footnote. So, whoops, you know, if you're going to have that as your number one case, you might want to at least mention it by name in your speech. Didn't happen. Of course, no Hitler order was ever found for any of these alleged border incidents.
Imagine that. Yeah. No orders. Well, you know, they did have that secret code right. That they can just wink and smile in a certain way, and that was a code to, you know, do genocide or invade or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Rick read between the lines. Of course. Okay, then that's another thing. Heydrich died in 1942, so of course he couldn't exonerate himself. So yes, Hitler wasn't even the mastermind of this. It was allegedly Himmler and Heydrich. Now, this essay kind of jumps between the two. Now, Himmler was actually Heydrich's superior. So if anyone ordered this, it would have had to have been Himmler, and he would had to have received at least affirmation from Hitler that this was okay.
Sure.
None of that exists. So there's no order anywhere, not from Himmler or Hitler, nothing for Gleiwitz. Now, there would be at least some paper trail or at least, you know, a copy concocted by the IMD, if nothing else, if this had happened. No, the only documentation we have for it is this absurd set of affidavits written up by basically a nobody named Alfred Naujox, who was in fact stricken from the SS because he had had many problems with his service. Kind of a sketchy individual.
And so really the incident was nothing until the IMT made it a big thing. And of course, since the winners write all the history, then they can spin it any way that they want.
Right.
And get the people, you know, like the guy to sign all those papers and give him a nice bunch of money, and off he goes in the sunset to be a businessman in Germany.
Sure. Yeah. And according to this essay, Hitler wasn't even the mastermind. So Heydrich was allegedly pleased with his job, that he's supposedly going to be kind of given some plan by Himmler. And so, in fact, the idea to stage counterfeit border incidents had come from Heydrich himself. He and Himmler had been prompting it to Hitler. And the Führer, the only one who could approve of such provocations, latched onto the idea. Hey, that's a great idea, you two. Come on. This is just great fiction. Great fiction.
There were so many provocations. Real provocations right after the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah. Months and weeks before the Gleiwitz incident.
Right. And just years.
Yeah. We should call it the Gleiwitz non-incident, actually.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. And here's another thing. they always cite the fact that the Bromberg Massacre happened after war was actually declared. But any people that can go do that simply because an invasion starts, there was obviously a pretext built up to that.
Oh, absolutely.
Idiotic to say that that was just totally out of the blue. Nothing had happened before that. That's not the way things like that work. Tensions mounting kind of a thing, context. Yeah. There had been plenty of incidents before that. So, yeah, that's just nonsensical. Canaris is weaved into this whole thing now. He's the head of the Abwehr, which is military intelligence. Military intelligence might have been more apt to do a false flag. That's actually plausible. Okay?
And he had connections to British intelligence.
Exactly. Exactly. So the fact that Canaris has been weaved into this story is quite interesting. You know, we know he had contacts with the Britsies, and he was a known traitor. And what's interesting is the investigation into the Abwehr's guilt in some kind of incident. We'll get to that. We might not get to it this time, but we'll get to it next time. We couldn't be proven. So even the Abwehr was exonerated. So what they did is they just kind of transferred it over to the SS that couldn't be exonerated because, as we know, the SS is the alibi of the nation. All the crimes and all the guilt goes on to the SS because that's just, you know, that's those kind of Germans. Those
right.
are extinct now.
Right.
Those weren't real Germans. Those were like from, you know, Mars or something. So here we have our list of people, Otto Hellwig, Hans Trommler, Otto Rasch, Herbert Mailhorn, and here's first Red Star, where we go, Red Slash would be more like it. The selection of Mailhorn was remarkable, for Heydrich did not at all get on with him. Totally different in character, the two men had fought out many conflicts in the past, so much so that Heydrich himself had been behind Mailhorn's transfer out of the SD. However, Mailhorn was an excellent organizer, and so Heydrich wanted him on the team. No. He couldn't find any other person, not one other person who was a good organizer. Well, he fires Mailhorn for jumping the gun and being such a bungling fool, an idiot, if we believe the story, and put some yak in there. So why did he pick Mailhorn in the first place? But that's the mystery. You have to weave in these people that can't exonerate themselves and were pointed out by others, such as Naujox. Oh, yeah, it was that Mailhorn guy. You know, the Allies probably just said, give us some names. Come on, think of someone. Was it this Mailhorn guy? He was in the SS? Yeah, it was him. That's how they do it.
Oh, of course.
You know, it's crazy. So, Mailhorn. Let me find his fate real quick here. I thought it was earlier in this. Here we go. So, Herbert Mailhorn. He died in 1968. He was never called to justice for his acts. Died October 30th, 1968, and he was allegedly committing all kinds of crimes and stuff in Slovakia, and as Gau bureaucrat, he was co-responsible for the elimination of the Jewish ghetto of Lodz in early 1944. So this guy allegedly cleaned out Jews and killed them, and yet not implicated. 1968, he dies. More than likely, Mailhorn supplied some information for the IMT too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he was able to tell a nice story. Kurt Palma is another one. Heydrich's chief adjutant, Kurt Palma, and some other SD functionaries were also present at the meeting that Heydrich and Mueller called, allegedly, for Hellwig, Trommler, Rasch, and Mailhorn. This was allegedly taking place at the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin on August 8th. Kurt Palma allegedly there. Well, he died or vanished in 1945 also. So, again,
right.
Heydrich's chief adjutant couldn't, you know, you got Heydrich gone and his chief adjutant, who would have had any information on Gleiwitz or his involvement thereof, both gone. Great. That really helps us out. So here we have welcoming his subordinates with the words, quote, "Gentlemen, you will by now have become aware yourselves that a war with Poland is inevitable," end quote. Now, how Heydrich knew this is pretty incredible, because not even Hitler knew this.
Right.
And we know that for a fact because Hitler actually called off the invasion and postponed it one time. I believe it was the 22nd, 23rd, or was it 20? No, I believe it's 25, 26. So they wait, and then September or August 31st, September 1st is when it actually gets reissued. So there was a pause there. Now, how did Heydrich know what not even Hitler knew? That's pretty incredible. And then who was the one who recorded that? Who quoted Heydrich? We don't get a source, so we have no idea who was in the room to say, "I remember exactly what Heydrich said."
Right.
So that's another one of those cute little novel-esque things. And I do find this a little odd that the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, would involve the Gestapo chief in the planning of this false flag. That would be Gestapo Müller. I would recommend people read Order of the Death's Head by Heinz Henna, because he kind of talks about how the SD and the Gestapo were rivals and how they clashed and, you know, what their jurisdictions were, what different missions were that they did. Yeah, it doesn't make sense that the SD and the Gestapo and the SS were all working intimately on this false flag.
Right.
And, of course, when you involve more agencies, including the Abwehr, we can't forget the Abwehr, Canaris, you got four agencies now, and it's supposed to be ultra-top secret.
I don't think so.
Proving its chances of being leaked when you involve that many agencies. It would be like the U.S. Marine Corps, the FBI, the CIA, and the U.S. government, State Department, let's say, all involved on one false flag.
Right.
See how that went down with 9/11. No
right.
one believes it. You don't want to be involving that many different factors. Not smart. Of course, in the U.S.'s case, I don't know.
Right.
They take stupid chances like that, I guess. Here's something interesting. Mailhorn. He's always the do-gooder, by the way. Mailhorn is always, like, questioning things and going, "I don't know about that, guys." So I'm sure he defended himself in that respect. He stated that it would create a responsibility for Germany that would be hard to bear in the face of history, and on a more practical level, that such operations were the responsibility of the Wehrmacht, not the SS. So this guy's telling Heydrich where to go.
Right.
Heydrich...
That's just not going to happen.
Dick, I'm thinking future here. What will this mean for Germany in the future? How will posterity think of us if we do this? This is what the guy's supposedly saying at the time.
Right. This is all just made up stuff after the fact.
Right.
So that they could create the reason to blame Germany. I mean, it's just...
I do like the fact that he dropped the bomb that this would be the responsibility of the Wehrmacht and not the SS, though. That would
yeah.
be one of our little gems from Mailhorn. Whoops! So that was a good thing he said that. I suspect the same thing. It would fall under Abwehr jurisdiction, certainly not Gestapo. That makes zero sense.
Right.
But in spite of Mailhorn's insubordination, it caught a thorn in the side to Heydrich. He kept him on board. Eh, why not? I want this guy ratting me out in the future.
Right.
So, like I wrote, sounds absurd, like the CIA putting a false flag responsibility on the U.S. Army. That's kind of a, a good way of relating Mailhorn's comment. You know, at least from the Allied perspective, IMT. So what the IMT is doing with Mailhorn's statement is they're saying, yeah, something like this, you know, it'd be like the CIA putting responsibility on the U.S. Army, SS putting responsibility on the Wehrmacht kind of a thing.
Right.
Something I mentioned in the side as a side note. Let's see. Okay, here's another thing that's insane. They involved 250 men in this, all SS members. 250 men?
My goodness.
Right. Yeah. And this task of getting together such a force, and mind you, most of them, if not all of them, had to speak English and have military training. This was assigned to Helvig, Otto Helvig. Really? I mean, who's this guy? So
right.
250 people, that's taken a huge chance. And by the way, none of these people ever talked. They apparently kept their vow of secrecy unto the day they died. So that doesn't make sense to me either. He died in 1962. So Helvig is another one who more than likely, because he was in the Einsatzgruppe, he would be guilty of war crimes.
Right.
Just being a member, a prominent leader in the Einsatzgruppe. So more than likely, he said what he needed to say.
Right.
I'll just wrap up on this point for now. At this point, I mean, we're talking about 250 men. You got to train them. They got to know Polish, blah, blah, blah. But Heydrich had not yet decided on the exact locations. He wasn't sure yet. What kind of
this? Yeah, does not make sense.
No.
This was definitely a creation by the Allies and using things that they were familiar with. And, of course, the OSS was preceded the CIA, and that's the kind of thing that they were doing over there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I wonder if they had anything to do with it, because they were certainly in the area, and then you factor in the people who were working with the Polish government. It just...
Right. I mean, unfortunately, the Allies don't declassify. The Chinese totally declassified because they lost. There's nothing there. So, yeah, it's the Allied governments that haven't declassified their files completely, and so we're at a loss on a lot of things.
Right. Well, I certainly look forward to you getting the white book so that and you can figure that out. And,
oh, yeah.
And
that'll help a lot. And then we'll just pick up where we left off on this and then get to the there's a really good essay. It's in one of the Der große Wendig volumes. And these are basically short revisionist essays published in Germany, in German. And one of them, you know, I've got it translated by Dr. Georg Jeckel. And this guy wrote extensively on the problems with Alfred Naujoch's affidavits. So
I'll
be able to get that one next time.
Okay. Right. Sounds wonderful. Okay, well, thank you so very much. And
having me.
We'll talk next week.
All right.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.